Good morning, everyone. Good to see all of you. If I've not met you before, my name is Chad, and I'm pastor here at this church. If you are following on at home, you may contact me through the website, and otherwise I'd love to meet you after our service. A number of years ago, I was in another church, and one of the senior members of our church, who was also one of our preachers, said, Chad, when I was at Bible college, I was always told there are a few passages in the Bible that should never be read aloud in church and should never be preached on, and this passage is one of them. And if it seems like we're just being a little bit gratuitous here, there's actually four really important reasons, other than the fact that, of course, this is God's holy word and he has put this story in here, but there are four reasons why we didn't want to just skip over it and go around it. And so as we go to our first slide, we just begin by sharing the very first reason behind this, and that is that this is a really important transitional story. If you want to think about a door on a hinge that swings both ways, this is going to remind us of two really important transitions. Number one, we're going to now move from a story of Jacob and his sons to a story of Joseph, who's going to spend the next few chapters over in Egypt. So it's going to swing us back and forth from the promised land of Canaan to Egypt. And it's also going to move us between Jacob and Joseph and his brothers. And so in some ways, this is kind of a meanwhile back at the ranch type story. Because while we start thinking, okay, well, the brothers are back there in Canaan and they're just doing whatever they're doing, and Joseph's over here and all the action's happening over here, this story, and in fact another story in Genesis 34 that we've had to go over, remind us that back in the land of Canaan, Jacob's sons are in a lot of trouble. And what's interesting about this is that a lot of the trouble are caused by two very important people amongst Judah's sons. The first one is Levi. So if you want to go back and read Genesis 34 on your own, basically another very confronting story where Jacob's only daughter, Dinah, is abused by the people, Canaanites, called the Shechemites. And Levi and his brother Simeon want to get revenge, and so they trick them and basically slaughter this whole village full of people. And so when Jacob hears what Simeon and Levi, who's going to become the head of the priestly clan, he said, you have brought trouble on me by making us a stench in the nostrils of the Canaanites who live around us, and they will gather against us, they're greater than us, and they will attack us, and they will kill us. So basically, through Simeon and Levi's rash decision to take revenge, these guys are in trouble from without. There is an external threat that they have become obnoxious in the land, and people are going to want to kill them. Then we move to this other important guy, Judah. And by the way, today when we talk about the Jews, I don't know that you understand that the Jews actually means those from the tribe of Judah. So large did the tribe of Judah become, and so all-encompassing, and the kingly tribe came out of the tribe of Judah. So Jews means those of Judah. It basically became the leading tribe and the namesake. Instead of Israel, people started talking about the Jews. So you heard in the early parts of this reading what is happening with Judah. Judah was the guy who had the bright idea to sell his brother down into Egypt. Okay, the leading guy of the tribe said, let's sell our brother down into Egypt. And then when we get to chapter 38, at that time, Judah left his brothers, the other guys from the tribes, and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hira. And there Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. And he married her and made love to her, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son, who was named Ur, and she conceived again and gave birth to another son named Onan, and she gave birth another time to Shelah. Judah has left his brothers, and he is now intermarrying with the Canaanites. And we know through both of these stories, the thinking of the Canaanites is that we're going to absorb these people into us. They're going to become part of us, and Israel will disappear, and they will become part of the Canaanite family of the world. But one of the interesting things is that when we get to the end of the book of Genesis, as Jacob's blessing his families, we're told that Judah is going to become the new blessed head of the Messianic line. In other words, the Messiah or the Christ is going to come from him. And so we're told in chapter 49, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nations shall be his. You know, right there back in Genesis is this incredible promise that Judah, through your line, the Messiah is going to come, who is going to rule over all the nations. But that's why we get this story. It's another story like that back in Genesis 34. Judah's royal line is in serious trouble. And so we get to this very, you know, this next part of this very kind of odious story. So Judah gets a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn was wicked. He's already become wicked, just like the Canaanites. And so the Lord put him to death. Then Judah says to Onan, the secondborn, sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother. But Onan knew that the child would not be his, so whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from providing offspring for his brother. And what he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord also put him to death. That's strike two if you are counting at home. Now, I need to explain to you a custom which eventually became codified in the Bible. And you can hear about this in the book of Deuteronomy, and also when Jesus has a debate with some of the religious leaders in Luke. That the idea here was, you know, keep in mind a promise had been made to Abraham, as we saw in the video. I'm going to bless you, I'm going to make you a great nation, and all people of the world will be blessed through you. Now God has moved most of the tribes of Israel down into the promised land, which they will inherit one day. So in a sense, they now have one job, and that is to make sure that they have children so they can become like the stars in the sky and like the sand on the seashore. And another really important part of this is that every single one of these tribes is important. Every single family and clan of every tribe is important. And the idea is that no one in Israel is lost, that everyone is included. And so while it seems like a strange thing to us today, they had this custom. Whereas if a brother died and it looked like his family line was going to die out, then another of his brothers would take his wife, and the very first child that they had would be named after the dead father. And so in this way, no family, no clan, no tribe was to be lost. Now you notice in this that Onan had no problem taking his brother's wife, but he said, I'm not going to have a child in my brother's name. So he would sleep with her but refused to get her pregnant. And in a sense, God says, you have this one job to do, but you won't carry on the blessing. So now God takes his life as well. As I said, now we have strike two. Now the interesting thing I want you to notice about this is that we are told through the scriptures that God took the life of these first two guys, that God judged them. But from Judah, the father's standpoint, Tamar is the kiss of death, all right? That's the way he sees it. You know, this woman that I have brought into my home, anyone that's married to her seems to die. And so he does this thing. He says to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, I want you to live as a widow, but leave my home, leave my family, and you go back. And then when my youngest son grows up, then I'll give her to you. But we also are told he's thinking, no, Sheila, if I give Sheila to him, then he might die too. Literally, this leaves Tamar in no man's land. We use that term father-in-law a bit casually in Australian culture, but father-in-law in the day meant father-in-law. That means Judah has total control over this woman. He can say, stay here with me, or in this case, go back home to your father. He can say, you can't marry anyone else. I want you to live as a widow. And as we will find out later on, he literally has control over whether she lives or she dies. So by moving Tamar completely out of his household and back home and forcing her to live as a widow, he has put her in a very hopeless and a completely desperate situation. And that is the situation of Tamar. And then, just in case we weren't following along and weren't picking up what was going on, we're told that after many days, Shua, daughter of wife Judah, died. And Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shearers, to Timnah, and he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. Basically, this is just helping us to understand Judah is not going to have any more children with his wife as well. So strike one with Ur, strike two with Onan. Judah's wife is dead, and he has no intention of handing his youngest Sheila over to Tamar. And you're kind of thinking to yourself, so does anyone care about what is meant to happen with this blessed line? And you got to be thinking that at one stage, this woman by the name of Tamar, surely she would have been told when she married into Abraham's family, you're marrying into a blessed family. God has promised that he is going to make our children like the stars in the heaven and like the sand on the seashore. And by this stage, she must be thinking, so where are all of these blessed children? Where are these blessed children? I don't see any. And Tamar is about to take matters into her own hands. And so we're told of this great plot that she has. And you might notice, if you've been following the story about Jacob and his family, guess what? We're going to have another disguise in order to achieve a blessing and another deception. There are certain themes that just keep coming up. So I'm reading from verse 14. So Tamar took off her widow's clothes and covered herself with a veil to disguise herself. And the veil was the garb of the shrine prostitutes. That way it protected their identity. And then she sat down at the entrance of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that though Sheila had now grown up, she had not been given to him as a wife. He never had any intention. When Judah saw her, he thought that she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and says, come now, let me sleep with you. By the way, let me just point out one other little thing that you may have missed out on. At least up to this point, Tamar has listened to what her father has said. She has gone and lived as a widow. She's still wearing the widow's garb. What have we been told? Judah's wife has died. He's also a widower. One of them is honoring her vows, and the other one sees the woman by the side of the road and says, how much? The other thing I want us to point out, especially when we move into next week, we'll be in the very next chapter, and I'll be preaching on the famous story of Joseph and Potiphar's wife, and we'll get this great compare and contrast, where day after day, Potiphar's wife will keep coming to Joseph and saying, sleep with me, come on, sleep with me, but he absolutely refuses. In this story, lest we think that it's something else, Tamar never says a word. She just simply told, your father-in-law is coming down the road, and she says, if I put myself there, I know what will happen. I know Judah's character. And sure enough, that's all the more that Tamar has to do. And so Judah says, let me sleep with you. And we now move from the disguise to the bargaining. And you have to remember, back in the days of Jacob and his brother Esau, and how Esau comes in and he wants the stew, and they bargain back and forth, and what will you give me? And here we have Tamar, and she wants to have her blessed children, and they are now going to do this bartering thing again. And there is a little bit of Jewish humor in all of this. She says, what will you give me? And Judah says, I'll give you a young goat from my flock. Now, I don't know if you picked up the humor here, but Judah has already promised her a kid from the flock. He's already said, you know, I'll give you my youngest kid. Just wait for him. But that has not been delivered. I've already been promised a kid from your flock. Okay. But I'll need some kind of pledge. How do I know that you will keep your promise to me? Because as we know, Judah isn't very good at keeping his promises. And so what he hands over is essentially the same thing as the 2 to 3 forms of ID. Back in the day, everyone had their own unique walking staff, which would have been shaped in a certain way, would have had certain carvings on it. It would have been attached with a cord, and there would have been a seal on the cord that you would have used to press into clay or into wax in order to make your particular mark. So to this anonymous woman on the side of the road, he hands over his 3 forms of ID. For me, it would be like I take my phone, it's got all my details, my credit card, everything you need is in there, and hands it over. The other thing I think we need to see in this story is that for Tamar, you know, this is not midday movie or some seedy little, this is strict business for her. When it's all finished, she goes and puts on her widow's clothes and waits to see what's happened. That's all the more detail that we're given in this story. But then when we get to verse 24, it's now 3 months later, and guess what? Judah is informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with a child by harlotry. And Judah says, bring her out to be burned. Who in the world does this? She's supposed to be acting like a widow. Where is the honor for the family? Who gets involved in prostitution when they should be honoring the dead? Who? And it reminds us a little bit of a story that comes up about Jesus in John's gospel. There's a woman who is caught in the act of adultery, we're told, and she is dragged out to be stoned to death. And you can't help but wonder, if she was caught in the act of adultery, then where is the man? And he is totally absent from this story. And Judah is outraged. Self-righteousness and justification takes over. And so Tamar was prepared for this very moment. As she was being brought out to be burned to death, she sent a message to her father-in-law, I am pregnant by the man who owns these. And she shows the 3 forms of ID. Whose staff is this? Whose cord? Whose seal is this? See if you recognize who these belong to. And we get to what is part of the punchline of the whole story, which leads us to the final point of all of this. What is real righteousness? She is more righteous than I. Now, there can be no doubt, and let me make it very clear to you in case you're wondering, there's not a righteous act in this whole story. Not a single righteous act that happens. But from Judah's standpoint, he's saying, look, fair is fair. I made a promise to her. It wasn't my youngest son, Shelah, who made the promise. I made the promise. I didn't fulfill the promise. She came back to the promise maker to collect the promise that was made to her. She's more right than I am. But it raises the question, as this sits within our Bibles, what is real righteousness? Before we get to that, we need to get to what is really the epilogue of this story from verse 27. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in the womb. Another great deja vu moment. And she was giving birth. One of them put out his hand so that the midwife took a scarlet thread and tied it to his wrist and said, "This one came out first." But when he drew it back, drew back his hand, his brother came out, and she said, "So this is how you have broken out." And he was named Perez. And then his brother, who had the scarlet thread on his wrist, came out, and he was named Zerah. And again, if you're following along through the whole story of Genesis, you can't help but go right back to the early chapters, Cain and Abel. This sibling rivalry which has come into the earth that will take over the whole earth. You know, whenever you see wars and rumors of wars and people getting along, it's always brothers and sisters fighting against one another. Every bit of conflict that we see in the world, close to home or far away, it's brothers and sisters who can't get along. And of course, this same thing happened when Jacob and Esau was born. And, you know, Jacob comes out holding on to his brother's heel. Everyone wants to get ahead, or as one song put it, everyone wants to rule the world. Everyone wants to be the justified one, the righteous one, the good one, and the ruler of all. So what do we do with this sordid little story in the middle of our Bible? Well, here's what the Bible itself does. Here's what the New Testament has to say. Matthew chapter 1, starting at verse 1. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David. Don't forget that Abraham was told a long time ago, through your seed, all people will be blessed. So we have Abraham, who became the father of Isaac, who became the father of Jacob, who became the father of Judah, who became the father of Perez and Zerah. But Matthew also goes on to say, and their mother was Tamar. And then, of course, it's interesting that you get these other mentions of women in Jesus' genealogy. For example, we hear about Rahab, who was a Canaanite prostitute in the city of Jericho. And it was by her faith that Israel was able to escape. And she helped them, and she was eventually adopted into the family of Israel, this Canaanite prostitute. Later on, we hear a story about the great-grandfather and grandmother of King David, a woman by the name of Ruth, who was a Moabite, who when the family went and left to live in the land of Moab. Ruth says to the mother-in-law, "Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God." And she is included into the family of Israel. And later on, through King David and his adultery, he meets this woman by the name of Bathsheba, who he's murdered her husband in order to get her. And all of these people are included in the family line of Jesus. We get King David and Solomon and a whole list of other royalty, and eventually we get to Jesus. So, what's the big point of all of this? Well, as we saw in the video, the theme verse of the entire book of Genesis really is what we did for evil, what we did against God, God keeps turning and redeeming and using for his good. God is a good and gracious king. And God is also sovereign over all things. We cannot ruin his plan of salvation. What we do against him, he can still turn and redeem for good. And the thing that I love most about all of this is that we sometimes talk about Jesus who came into the world to become the friend of sinners. This is the big thing that I want to say to us today. Jesus is not our friend. He's our family. Jesus didn't just come into the world to become the friend of sinners. He came into the world to belong to our family. He would be called the son of Adam and Eve, the son of man, that sinful couple at the very beginning of the Bible. He would become the grandson of Judah and Tamar. He would become the child of Rahab, the Canaanite prostitute. He would become the child of Ruth, the Moabite. He would become the child, the royal child, of the product of King David and Bathsheba's sin. And on it goes. Jesus chose to enter into our family tree and to become not just our king, but become our brother, to become our family. We're going to have a chance to reflect on these things a little bit more during communion, but we're going to sing a song now, maybe one of the best well-known songs around the world, called Amazing Grace, and really think about these words. And then after this song, our live streamers will leave us and we will share in communion together.